Kara Hurst, welcome to Cable.
Thanks so much for having me, Bill.
Kara Hurst is director of the Oregon Health Justice Recovery Alliance that's working to ensure that Oregon's new law decriminalizing possession of small amounts of illicit drugs that was passed through ballot initiative by an emphatic 59% to 41% vote. Oregon became the first U.S. state and joins Portugal as the first nation on the planet to decriminalize small amounts and thus challenge the enormously destructive punitive drug control policy that relies on police and prison that's doing so much now and through the past on harming all of us. But there's lots of interests that have profited from the drug wars and have successfully created widespread fears, indeed more than fears, terrors and panics about illicit drugs. And while they can hardly support return to the police and mass incarceration system, they continue their critique in Oregon of its decriminalization law and implementation. The Oregonian newspaper, in its zeal to smear any public program except high school and college football, it's given a lot of coverage to the critics. Kara will start later in the interview to evaluate these critiques, but first, Kara, remind us of the law's provisions and the great virtues for this country and indeed every place on earth of decriminalization and treating drug use as a public health problem instead of police and prisons and their enormous waste of lives and resources.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. So Measure 110 was really created in response to the addiction and overdose crisis, and it was also created, you know, to help address the suffering that we're all seeing on our streets by increasing access to critical services, including housing. Basically, it removes criminal penalties for possession of small amounts of drugs in favor of a more health-based and science-backed approach to substance use. So rather than labeling drug users as criminals, what Measure 110 does is it treats substance use as a public health issue that's really affecting all of us, right? From siblings to children to our teens, pregnant women, and grandparents. There isn't anybody who is untouched from this public health issue. And so at this point, people in our communities who've been seeking harm reduction and addiction recovery services will soon be able to access those services more quickly, closer to home, and by someone hopefully that can share their cultural background as well as language. So the people who lack health insurance or access to good health insurance really won't have to worry about trying to pay for these services, because Measure 110 ensures that these services are free. And, you know, ultimately, as the U.S. has been criminalizing drug use for over 50 years, it truly has proven that it's not only cruel and has eviscerated communities, but it's also really ineffective. And more people are incarcerated than ever before, and more people are addicted than ever before. So that doesn't show us that this is a system that has been working. Oregon ranks second in the nation for substance use disorder and 50th in access to services. And really, Measure 110 is a tool in the toolbox to try and create more access to services and really work towards making sure that we can destigmatize addiction and substance use so that more people will feel safe to come forward and ask for help, which is what they found in Portugal to be the case.
Let's go a little bit more deeply into the problems created for people of a drug arrest, and it gets on their record, and even if it's dismissed, and even if they get some treatment or are forced into it, even if they don't go to jail, which is so common, even for small amounts, particularly with harsh judges who think they're protecting their county or city.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me we have to really recognize how deeply hurtful it is to people who, many of them, in fact, were leading relatively ordinary lives before they wound up in the justice system, and especially people of color.
Yeah, I don't think people realize, like, just the amount of damage that a criminal record can create, and that it really does create lifelong barriers. So a record for even a misdemeanor drug charge can sometimes be an automatic barrier to getting a job, housing, qualifying for a credit card or student loan, and can also automatically disqualify people from being eligible for certain professional licenses. So those pieces are, you know, exactly what we all encourage and want to help support people to have access to while we're creating these meaningless these barriers that don't help anybody. They actually create a world where they're having to go deeper into debt, not be able to create any kind of generational wealth or support for their families and their communities, and aren't able to access the simple things that we all need to be able to survive and be successful. A good job, safe housing, and, you know, for folks who want to go to school, to be able to get a student loan. I don't think anybody wants to create those barriers for folks, and that's never been a motivator for someone to seek help either. You know, we've spent more than a half a century to arrest our way out of this health crisis, and it really has created harms that span generations. The disproportionate impact of drug war related policies and practices on communities of color, which is what you talked about, it really means that they've been most harmed by economic and employment disenfranchisement. And that we're seeing play out in our communities in a really devastating way. So being able to at least decriminalize small possession of drugs means that we are creating less barriers for people to access basic needs like housing and employment.
And it also, it seems to me, and it's shown in Portugal, it reduces the deaths from overdoses or suicide of people who feel they've become unproductive for their families, they're a burden on others, they're having trouble, in fact, breaking the habit. Even if they're able to hold a job and do quite well, they still, after an arrest, become, it's profoundly depressing.
Well, I think what's important is what you see with Portugal is that when their law went into effect, in a few years after, their overdose death rate went down significantly from the rest of the European Union's overdose rate. So what they were able to see is when we destigmatize, when we decriminalize substance use, and we provide a pathway to services, less people feel the shame and the harm of substance use, and they have access to get these services. Now, there is a difference, unfortunately, between Oregon and Portugal, a glaring difference, which is Portugal has a socialized healthcare system and we don't. So they have more services. That being said, we are investing $300 million, which is five times more than Oregon has ever invested in these non-Medicaid services like housing, peer supports, low barrier treatment services, and overdose prevention harm reduction services. When we invest that kind of money into these services with community-based providers who know what they're doing and know how to work with the population and their communities, we will also see these results, and we already have. We invested $30 million early. They were called Access to Care Grants, and the studies from OHA showed that 16,000 people were able to access services they wouldn't have been able to access if Measure 110 funds and Measure 110 had not been in place. So that's 16,000 people who were able to get whatever it was, the help that they needed in that moment, instead of having to, you know, either go hide back in the shadows or, you know, didn't have the tools to reverse an overdose death. These are all critical components of the law that people are not talking about in the media, and it's not being represented. They're focusing on a small amount of calls going into a hotline when ultimately the hotline was never meant to be the only and sole access point for folks to be able to get support. We want to make sure that there's no wrong door to getting these services and that all the services are free to the person seeking them. That means that you can walk into any space and get help. It also means that we'll have a lot more outreach and peers out there working with folks on their timeline and letting them know that there's more support and help available, and when they're ready, or if they're ready at that moment, then they can start connecting them to housing and outpatient and sobering and detox centers. So, you know, this will take a lot of time. You can't take a starved system that is ranked 50th and think that you can infuse some money in and that, you know, that we'll all of a sudden be out of the crisis that we're in. But we're also not making the crisis worse, which is huge when you look at what the impact has been on providers through COVID. Many had to close shop. Many of them had to move to telehealth. there's a myriad of issues that face our providers, and they're just starting to claw and dig their way out. And because we have these funds to support them doing that, they're able to see more people. And that's where that 16,000 number, I think, is so important for people to recognize that a lot of people are getting the help that they need right now through Measure 110 dollars. And that was only 10% of the funds. So we're about to see a $265 million investment spread across every county in Oregon, focused on those science-based, evidence-informed practices of housing, peer supports, harm reduction, overdose prevention, and low barrier treatments.
This is KBOO Radio 90.7, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick there for the Old Mole, talking to Tara Hurst, the director of the Oregon Health Justice Recovery Alliance, that's working to ensure that Oregon's new law decriminalizing possession of small amounts of illicit drugs, that it's properly implemented. Tara worked with the Measure 11 campaign that fought for Measure 10 in Oregon, passed by 59% to 41%. But in the excitement of the November 20 election that defeated Donald Trump, it didn't make the national headlines it deserved. But Measure 10, its decriminalization of small amounts of drugs, including the hardest ones, and it's setting up county networks of helping services, that's enormously important. No U.S. state has ever attempted it. We just discussed the law's provisions and its virtues, but interests that profited from the former police and prison treatment of drug use, though these interests can hardly defend the former laws and practices, they're still attacking. The one that the treatment group programs are being set up and funded much too slowly. Another critique that the law didn't require people apprehended to attend sessions with the county program. And also been critiquing that Portugal, in fact, did that, Oregon didn't. We'll be talking to Tara about the virtues of non-coercion. And they're also critiquing that the hotline set up by county programs allegedly got few calls. Tara spoke to that earlier. So, Tara, it's been a year and a half, and a lot of money has already been sent to very troubled, because of COVID and other reasons, programs that have been deeply wounded. Tell us about the slow rollout, though.
No, I think, we've been the ones out there probably most loudly critiquing the slow rollout, because we see just how it impacts the folks on the ground not having access to the services that they need, and the providers not being able to keep their doors open. And it's having real impacts on the ground. That being said, there was a delay. The money was supposed to be out in January, then February, and you can imagine March, April, May, and now the money is starting to come out. I think there's 10 to 16 counties that now have established networks and are being funded. And, we are cautiously optimistic that it will continue to roll out in a much quicker fashion. There was a lot of problems with the rollout. I will say that, like anything, there's always going to be challenges when you try something new and when you try to buck a system that has been pretty engrossed in status quo and maintaining, status quo outcomes. So this was a heavy lift, but it's also an important and critical lift. And we really need all of our bureaucracies, especially the health authority, to continue to treat this and definitely treat this as an emergency that it is. And that hasn't always been the case. I will say that this is an agency that has had to grapple with some of the biggest issues that we've been facing in the last 2 years, being the health authority with, COVID. And as it's been reported, Oregon's done pretty well with COVID, considering what other states have been through. So you have to keep all of that in mind. And when you commit to timelines and you commit to getting money out and you break those commitments over and over again, you lose trust with the public. And so I think that we're all working hard to try and make sure that these funds get out. And we're going to start seeing, we've already started seeing funds out and networks being established and created, and really important money going into community provider programs that are life-saving. So the rollout, people pushing back and critics, including us, I think that's all fair criticism. And I look forward to having some real conversations about how to make sure that it doesn't happen the next time and that we're able to do a much more equitable process next time. So that's kind of where we're at on the funds. We're looking forward to seeing the tri-counties get up and running, since that is where our heavy population center is, and see those providers in Multnomah County. There's 41 or 43 providers that will be getting funds to provide more services, and a lot of them are culturally specific providers, and this is something that we've never had. So this is exciting time, and people should feel hopeful more than anything else, I hope, at this point, to know that, you know, due to advocacy, due to pushing and a lot of hard work, these funds are getting out there.
Yeah, I have a lot of sympathy for people in the public sphere, public workers of almost any agency. They're heavily critiqued when a program that they funded goes bad and it turns out to be a poor investment for the state. Now, it means they often bend over backwards to evaluate where the money's going and doing all the auditing. And that stuff takes time, especially when there are new programs being set up. And I know that the networks are being set up. So it's not so surprising that things go slowly, in my sense, although they shouldn't promise so much, you know, success in, yeah, in funding programs when they really can't meet the deadlines. And they're always sitting in fear that the Oregonians is going to find one which was scamming the state.
Right.
As if scammers don't take billions and billions from our private corporations or bounders or the various people who prey on the economy. Tara, one last question. Portugal, in fact, requires in its law people who are apprehended possessing even small amounts of drugs. There's penalties for not going to the local county group or the locality, the people who are doing drug treatment and trying to control drugs. They're penalized for not meeting with the people and discussing not just the perils of drugs, but discussing the extent to which they're really using and whether they need treatments. Now, there's no demand that people go into a treatment program, but there is a demand in the law that they discuss whether, in fact, they may need one. My sense is that Portugal, people trust the health system and especially a lot of the social service systems much more than they do in the United States, where they have been linked up with the police power and incarceration and deep, deep penalties, even the child welfare system, which has its own deep problems. But tell us about the question of coercion.
Well, coercion, coercing people into treatment, it not only undermines their dignity and autonomy, but the evidence suggests that coercion treatment is ineffective. So data shows that the risk of dying immediately after discharge from compulsory care for addiction is very high, especially for younger clients. And, you know, services should be evidence-based and voluntary and accessible. And that's exactly what Measure 110 does. You can spend a lot of money pushing somebody into treatment, but if they're not ready for the help, it's not going to be a successful outcome. And sometimes it can actually be a detrimental outcome to force somebody. We don't have access to treatment in a way, even if we did, we don't have the health system built that Portugal has in order to be able to kind of create those pathways that they did. I also think that Oregon needs to do it differently, and Oregon needs to do it in a way that will work for us. And that means building a system of care that is free, that can be accessed through any door, and that doesn't have barriers, while at the same time ensuring that Oregonians are no longer penalized and saddled with barriers that can last a lifetime due to, you know, a drug charge. And if you think about these penalties and making sure that we, you know, people say, well, we want to, the $100 fine can be waived. Yeah, it can be waived by accessing a peer support who can talk through what your needs are, especially from a mental health or behavioral health perspective, but also some fundamentals. Do you need housing? Have you had a meal? What do you need to kind of move to the next level? And that's really important. What's less important and what's less interesting or effective is making sure that somebody pays their $100 fine. And if they don't, you know, they rack up penalties and fines, and then they end up with a warrant and end up getting saddled with all of those barriers just for having a small amount of drugs in their pocket. So I think that we just have to, as a society, really shift our mind frame from punishment is the only way to get somebody to stop using drugs, when that's just not the case. That's not been an effective tool. And we are moving towards a healthcare model. There's no other healthcare or disease that we treat that we do forced treatment on, and that we criminalize people if they don't access that treatment. You know, so the realities are, this is the only, substance use is the only medical condition that we really do this with, and it's not effective, just like it wouldn't be effective for treating diabetes or any other life-threatening disease.
Yeah, I did a lot of reading some years back on Alcoholics Anonymous and why it worked. And one problem they had was when people addicted or on the road to addiction or whatever, when a judge decided that they needed treatment, they would often say, if you go to AA, I won't put you in jail. We'll keep watching you, but we won't put you in jail. And, you know, some kind of informal relationship like that. Well, the people then go to AA, and they're hostile. You know, they don't feel part of it. They don't want to cooperate. On the other hand, AA works pretty well because it's, in fact, not a state program. No one's demanded to be there. And they don't, in fact, some of the programs try to tell the judges and others, please don't ruin our program by requiring people to show up. Anyway, I guess that's my story. I don't know if it's accurate or not. You would know better.
Well, I mean, as someone who attended AA for years, and it, you know, literally, you know, treatment and detox in AA did save my life. I also choose not to go now, and am still in recovery. I think that that's a real personal choice, and it's a personal path. And, you know, they always say that you can't get sober for someone else. You need to do it because you're ready. And I believe that. You know, sometimes if you're exposed to something long enough, something may come through, but that's what we're working with the peers, right? You have somebody, it's a similar model where somebody with lived experience who has been, though, trained in how to work with someone who's struggling can reach out, can talk to you, can start working with you and identifying ways that maybe you can get the support that makes sense and works for you at that time and isn't being mandated by a judge or law enforcement or anyone else for that matter. That's where you get real outcomes. That's how you actually get to a place where people who are seeking recovery or who need recovery are able to choose that for themselves. I know that that's not satisfying for folks because they just want to see people who use drugs kind of off the streets and out of their sight, but that's not a humane way to look at this issue, and it's really not an effective way. So I think people need to recognize that the science is very clear that mandated enforced treatment or court-forced treatment, although sometimes can work, it is not an effective strategy, and so we need to move away from that. If you think the only reason to do something is because you're going to get punished, it's very different than recognizing, I need help, I need support, where can I go to get it? And that help actually being there and you're not placed on a 6-month waiting list. That's our issue. Our issue is not having the services and the access to services that we desperately need here in Oregon.
This is KBU Radio. Bill Resnick signing off. An interview with Tara Hurst, the director of the Oregon Health Justice Recovery Alliance. It's working to ensure that Oregon's new law decriminalizing possession of small amounts of illicit drugs is properly implemented. So, Tara, how do people learn more about the law and how to get in touch with the Health Justice Recovery Alliance?
They should go to our website, healthjusticerecovery.org, and there's lots of great information on that website, including community resources, and we're constantly updating it and adding new content. There's also, OHA has their own site dedicated to Measure 110. So if you Google OHA Measure 110, you'll also get a lot of really good information and resources to learn more.
Thanks a lot for talking to us today, Tara Hurst.
Thanks for having me.